accession number 33623.
Reel 2.
Basil King, reel 2. Can you tell me about the rifle drill, the initial rifle drill that you did, obviously, while you were training at Skegness?
Well, it was very limited. Somewhere along the line, I completed examinations, and it was designated that I would be a telegraphist. I didn't have any choice. That was what I was given. You will be a telegraphist in the Royal Navy.
Oh, so you'd already had that, you were already allocated to that position?
Yes.
from the point, yes, that you volunteered?
I got letters to prove it, that I was told that you will be a telegraphist.
But with the Skegness training, you had to go through
that
every element of induction, didn't
that's
you?
Right. So where do you want to start? Where are we?
Well, with that, you were just going to tell me about, it was limited rifle drill, but what did it involve?
Well, it wasn't very much. It was a question of present arms, and that was more or less it. I mean, there was no question of using a bayonet or that sort of thing. It was just initial induction, really, into a rifle. We never fired a rifle. We would never even pull the bolt back. We just shouldered arms and presented, full stop, and that was it. End of rifle training.
And can I ask you about the chalet accommodation? What was the chalets like at Skegness?
Well, you wouldn't remember Billy Button's chalets. They were two windows besides a door. It was just a chalet, a wooden chalet. Inside were two beds, a wooden wardrobe, and a sink. Full stop. That's all. If you wanted to wash, you went down to the ablutions down the bottom of the chalet line, and you washed down there. And you had to be careful who you were bunked with, because the buggers would piss in the sink in the chalet. You're talking about the facilities in the camp. I mean, we had adequate bedding. We were always warm and well looked after. There was no question of that. It was basic. But it was good, and that was something that a lot of the chaps had never experienced in their lives before. They'd never been looked after properly.
And who were your instructors in that period?
They were all chiefs, most of them. You know, boys, chaps that had been in the Navy, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, they knew everything about it. They knew it all. You know, you blokes don't know anything at all. You know, if you want to know something, you ask me. If you don't think, you ask me. So that's how it was. There's really nothing more to say about Skegness, apart from we used to go ashore. Well, but they called it ashore from Skegness. When you're in the Navy, if you're going out of camp, you're always going ashore. So we used to go down to Skegness, and there was a fish shop down there called Sam Isaac's. And you could get a fish and chip supper for 1 shilling and 6p. And as you went in through the door, there was a distorting mirror. And over the mirror it said, "Weary and thin, they stagger in." So we'd go in and have our fish and chips supper and tea and what have you. And on the way out, there was another distorting mirror that said, "Fat and stout, they waddle out." So that's what we used to do down in Skegness. Then we used to go up in the weekends to Inga Mills, which is a village up, little way up. But apart from that, you stayed in the camp most of the time. And I can't remember what entertainment there was. I think there was a cinema. I can't remember now. But it was, the entertainment was nil, really. We entertained ourselves. So that was the end of, really, of my 6 weeks at HMS Royal Arthur. Then, because it was already designated that I would be a telegraphist, I was drafted to HMS Scotia in Ayr in Scotland to train. Well, I was there for 9 months learning the business, and after that 9 months we had a certificate to say that we got the Postmaster General certificate for something or other that I can't remember now. But it was quite difficult. We had a chalet, exactly the same. It was a Butlins camp. We had a chalet, and we had a chap in our chalet that came from the Gorbals in Scotland. His name was Banger Jackson. And this chap used to itch, and he used to go up against the bedpost and scratch himself against the bedpost, you see. So we got fed up with this, so we called the chief and said, "Chief, this guy's scratching." So we wheeled him down to the MO, the sick bay, and this chap had got scabies. Well, you've never seen such a kerfuffle in all your life. The squad came up, the chalet was stripped out, it was disinfected. We were all taken down to the sick bay, where we had, which I disliked very much, we had to strip. A bath was prepared with hot water, which included a large dose of Lysol. And we stood there, and a sick bay tiffy with a large brush had a bucket of cream liquid, which he proceeded to paint you all over and stuff it up your private parts with this brush, with this ointment. And then you got in the bath, and you had to lie there. And if you've ever lied in a hot water bath with Lysol, you will feel how it grips your extremities. And I didn't like it. I got out and had the treatment with the brush again. And the tiffy said, "You can put your clothes on now, put your uniform on now, but don't dry yourself." So I had to put my uniform on. And I think I had that treatment 3 times. And we all blessed Banger Jackson. We didn't half kick his ass. So then after that...
Well, I was going to ask actually with that, can you take me through the training, Basil, how you learnt to be a telegraphist?
Well, we all sat down in front of, we all had a desk like you would at school. On each desk was a Morse key, and you had earphones. Sitting in front of the class was a chiefie, a POTEL, I've forgotten what he was called now. But anyway, he started to describe, he gave us a book about Morse code, which we had to look at and digest. And then he proceeded to tap out the Morse code on through our earphones. And we just listened. And he went through each letter. And eventually you acclimatised. So you see... If you look at a Morse code, if you look at C, it looks like dardit, dardit. But it's not. It's dardit, ardit. And it's the rhythm of the Morse that you get to know. It takes time. It takes time to be able to read it. You can hear it, but you can't transpose it because you can't read it quick enough, because you haven't got the rhythm. So eventually, you after about so many weeks, you have a test on a small part. And you listen to that and you write it down. And it's marked. And then you go through it again and again and again. And it gets more difficult. And you go through it again and again and again. Until eventually, you're able to use the key yourself and transmit to the chief who's sitting at his desk.
So when you're doing that, am I right in thinking that you're not concentrating on each individual letter? Are you listening almost to a flow of more to get the meaning?
Yeah, you have. Yeah, you have. It takes some time. You can learn Morse. You can learn the you can learn C, like dadit, N, and da, and T, and all the rest of it. But you can't put it down until you get the rhythm, and that's what takes the time. But eventually it comes. All of a sudden it will come. You got it. And so eventually, after so many months, you have an examination. You're either going to fail or you're going to pass. You've got to get 95%. If you don't get 95%, you're out. You're going to be a stoker or a seaman. So you don't get any leave either, because after every examination, you've got leave. And that was something else too, because you were in Scotland. And getting from Scotland down to Oxford was extremely difficult. Going on the trains, the trains ran to time, but the trains were absolutely packed. I don't think, in my Navy days, I hardly ever had a seat on a train. I usually sat down in the corridor. Anyway, we had leave after every, I think we had three examinations, and we had weeks leave after each examination. In the final, I think we had a fortnight's leave. I can't remember. But I passed, and I got 96 or 97%, I can't remember. So I'd qualified enough to actually be the sole operator on a trawler.
So with the taking down of Morse, do you have to take down a specific sort of number of words a minute or something of that order? Do you have to be able to achieve a certain rate with them?
Yeah, you do. There's another I can show you, actually. No matter. No, I mean, you not only, you have to learn coding as well. You have to learn fleet code. So that's a mixture of letters and numbers. And other bits and pieces. So you've got to get all this under your belt before you're allowed actually to be drafted. Once you've done your final examination and they're satisfied that you're okay, you're drafted. And that's what happened to me.
So it's a 9-month long period of training, and it's a solid, essentially a solid block of training to get you up to a certain standard.
It's not, I mean, we're not talking about an hour a day. We're talking about 6 hours a day. You're at it all day. Very little exercise. There was no routine like at Skegness. You were there solidly to learn this, to how to be a telegraphist. And that's what you did all day, every day.
And were there some people on the course who just couldn't get it, who
yes.
couldn't hear the rhythm?
Oh, yes. There were quite a lot. So they were, after each examination, some were quite hopeless. They couldn't do it. And so they were drafted, they were taken off the course.
And I take it then from that, it's in a sense, it's you get to a point where you sort of get your ear into what you need to be listening to.
Yes. I could eventually read Morse without writing it down as it came across. It's like reading a book. Once you know it and you've got the rhythm, you can see it. And you've got it. And it's, Sometimes I listen on the radio on the shortwave, and Morse comes across there. I can transmit it in my mind, but I can't get it quick enough to. It's got 70 years. It's too long.
And your accommodation there again? What was
in Challis, exactly the same as Skegness, no different. It was in Ayr that after we went and did Ayr finals, us lads went to Alloa to the Tam O'Shanter Inn, where Robbie Burns used to go, and it was. We all piled into this pub, and I mean, I was 18. I'd never drunk. And we sat behind this table in front of a roaring fire, and I had a pint of beer, and I think I had another pint of beer. But after a second pint, I felt absolutely bloody dreadful. I could hardly stand up, and I staggered out to the loo, and it was primitive. The loo was a whitewashed urinal, and I stood at the trough there, and I was having a pee, and I was so drunk I was holding myself up by leaning my head against the whitewashed wall. And as I was peeing, there was a chap next to me, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Son, you've got a smashing set of teeth," because I was just about to be sick. And I got out of the urinal, and I left my gear and my coat in the pub, and I went outside. It was raining, and I slumped down outside the pub on the floor. And the chaps eventually came out the pub with my cap and my coat, and they put my coat on me, held my arms, and we all went back to the ship, and they paraded me through the gate, you know, as jolly sailors, and I could hardly stand up. I've never been drunk in my life again. That was the first and last time. I might have got a wobble on occasions, but never drunk. So that was HMS Scotia. I quite liked it, actually. I quite enjoyed Scotland.
Was that an element to that as well, though? Because obviously by that stage you're in the Navy and you're learning a trade, aren't you, as
That's
such.
Right.
Is that a satisfactory sort of position to be in?
Well, it was nice to get the wings to stitch on your uniform. The wings with the flash through the centre. You know, you felt that you'd achieved something, which was good. I mean, I'd hardly ever achieved anything in my life, but I was quite proud of that, actually. So I was drafted. I think I went down to HMS Mercury. That was down in Hampshire. I can't remember where that was now. It was an old, very old mansion. I remember I had to polish the floors with a mop. I remember that, and had to whitewash all the stones going up the drive, all useless things to keep you occupied.
Are you waiting on draft then, really?
On draft, yeah. And then something else happened. I thought I was going to be drafted to a ship, but I wasn't. There was myself, Mike Mayer and Don Gibbons. We were selected. We had to go to Eastbourne to go on another course, which was a direction finding course, which involved Morse code. So I was in billets down in Eastbourne, in a private house, where an old gal charged us threepence a day for extra porridge. But we had this course, and it was to identify U-boats. When a U-boat comes out of the water, before he attacks, he must notify Berlin before he does so. And to do that, he sticks his aerial out of the water, and he transmits Morse. At that moment, you sitting in front of a FH-4, which is like a radio with an auto gyro compass round an oscilloscope, which is tuned to the enemy frequency. When he transmits, your flash on your oscilloscope bounces and you read off the bearing. You pick up a telephone and you transmit to the fleet that there's a U-boat in bearing so-and-so. If you're with a carrier, you fly off aircraft, and with a bit of luck, it's good night, Irene, down to David Jones' locker for a U-boat, if you're lucky. Anyway, we're getting a bit far ahead now.
So you were trained on that course. Was it a practical element to that course? Were you trained on it?
That's right.
Would somebody be then sending signals through to you?
It was actually. I can't remember an awful lot about it now, but I know that it was easily accomplished. And then I was drafted again. I think it was Collingwood. I can't remember. And then us three were drafted to HMS Caprice, the 6th destroyer flotilla of the Home Fleet, which was based in the Western Approaches. So we were drafted to Glasgow to try and pick up the ship, but the ship wasn't there. So by this time it was getting late at night, so we were sent on to one of the hulks out in the harbour. Now the hulks are these old 15th, 16th century ships where you sort of stayed overnight. Well, if you've ever tried to sleep in a 5'3" bunk when you're 6'2½, it's no joke, because that's the size of the bunk for medieval, you know, Middle Eastern, well, ancient mariners, really. And we were there one night, and then the following day we were sent up to the harbour master thought the ship was at Arica, at Liverpool. No, it was at Liverpool. So we went to Liverpool, but the ship wasn't there either. So it was arranged, we'd had transport, we had a lorry, and they took us 40 miles up to Loch Long to Arica, where the Caprice was. Well, we arrived at Arica, and we piled out of the truck, and there was nothing there except the lock and one building, a jetty, an HMS Caprice tied up at the end of the jetty. And I was amazed. I couldn't believe it. I looked at this ship and I thought, am I really going to get a sea in that ship? And there was just a wisp of smoke coming out of the funnels. And I looked at it and I saw the gun, 4.5-inch guns, fore and aft, the 8 torpedo tubes, the Oerlikon and the Chicago sitting on the bridge wings. And I thought, this is going to be great. And at that moment, the POTEL Potts came off the ship, and he said, right, lads, this way. So we picked up our gear, and we went on board, and we took us through the galley flat, through the forward mess, and he pointed to a dead light stand that was upright, and he said, down there, mess 3, forward mess. And I looked at this mess, and I thought, I don't like being down there. But anyway, it had to be. So that's what we did. We had to be in mess three, lower four, forward mess deck. There were 32 of us on the deck. There were 16 telegraphists on the left hand side, on the port side, and 16 bunting tossers on the right, on the starboard side. And that's how we lived. We did normal duties when in port. We did normal duties in the radio room, but when at sea, the three of us took watches in the. We had an office on the bridge wings where our equipment was sited, and we had an armchair in front of the equipment, and the office just took one person, just about. And when we were at sea, we were for in three watches, we would take 4 hours each for three people. So you were 4 hours on, 8 hours off, which was fine.
How was that arranged with that? Was it just a rota, a continual rota?
That's right. That was it. Until someone, the captain, would decide you're in two watches. So that's 4 hours on, 4 hours off. Today, tomorrow, the next day, whenever. And if you've ever been in a situation where you're 4 hours on, 4 hours off, all you do is grab some sleep. You see, now it comes down to the conditions on board. You can't think of the Navy in 1943-44 like the conditions are in the Navy today. I mean, today they go to sea in a hotel. They don't go to sea in a warship. They have canteens and choice of food. We didn't. We fed ourselves.
So what were the messing arrangements that you had?
We were allowed, and I can't remember how much a day it was. I think it was threepence a day per man. So we had 16 of us. We had 48 pence a day to feed ourselves. To feed ourselves. Not in a canteen. You went up to the naffy. There was a small hatch with a naffy bloke behind. And you ordered what food you want. You got tins of milk. You might get a bit of meat, you got some potatoes, rice, anything that you needed within your, and it was logged against your mess. If you went over that, you paid. If you went under that, you had an extra pint of beer. But we would get our provisions and take it down onto the mess deck and prepare food. Now, one of the staple diets, what we used to call pot mess, you had a kettle, which is like a big saucepan, and you'd pour everything in. You'd chuck the corned beef in, you'd chuck the meat in, the tomatoes, the beans, the peas, you'd stir it all around, take it up to the galley, put it on the stove, and boil it up. Then you'd take it down to the mess. Have you ever tried taking a hot kettle when there's a heavy sea rolling through the galley flats, down the mess, down the hatch? It's no joke. So you have your food.